You're listening to Popaganda, a Bitch Radio podcast. Remember, Bitch Media is a nonprofit organization and we rely on listeners like you for support. Visit bitchmedia.org/donate to find out how you can get more involved. Welcome back to another episode of Bitch Popaganda. I'm Kelsey Wallace, the web editor at Bitch, and with me today are...
Andy Zeisler, the editorial creative director of Bitch.
Julie Falk, executive director.
And today we're going to talk about paying for content on the web, and we're going to talk about the legacy of Nora Ephron, and then we're going to take you to the movie theater to see Magic Mike. So let's get started. A couple of weeks ago, there was an interview with Erica Jong on The Slant, where she made some comments about specifically Arianna Huffington and how the Huffington Post doesn't pay for a lot of its web content, but also just kind of saying in general that as an artist, she feels like websites that don't pay their contributors are doing a real disservice, not only to the individuals, but also just to writing and journalism as a whole. Obviously, here at Bitch, we are a media outlet and have some thoughts on this. Just before we get started, I'll say that we do pay for all of our web content, not as much sometimes as we'd like to, but we definitely make it a point to not post any content for free. On the other hand, I think we all probably read a lot of sites that do post a lot of unpaid content, and, you know, it's complicated. So, Andy, I don't know if you want to start. Do you have any thoughts about the ethics of publishing some of that stuff, or kind of when you decide to pay someone versus when you don't?
Yeah, well, this is something that we, when Lisa and Ben and I started Bitch, we really struggled with, because at first we were a zine. We couldn't afford to pay contributors, and there was no expectation in zine land that contributors would get paid. But at a certain point, we realized we really wanted to make that a priority, because we wanted to sort of live the mission of the magazine, and the mission of the magazine was really prioritizing alternative voices, and part of that means paying for them, especially because mainstream media often didn't want them. I think the internet has so changed journalism and opinion writing and everything that people are basically doing what they can get away with in a market that can bear it, and that, you know, that's making for a really difficult climate in which to be a freelance writer who needs to get paid.
Well, I completely agree, and I think that not paying writers delegitimizes the work, and it's essential that we consider journalism and writing a legitimate profession in a democracy, and I really don't want to be part of the problem, and it's I don't want to. It's hard for me to read content that I know that writers are not being paid for, because I feel like it contributes to the problem.
Yeah, I blogged for the Huffington Post for a very, very short time, about 4 or 5 years ago, and I realized right away that I didn't feel ethically good about blogging for them. I was getting nothing out of it, because my posts were getting buried, because the paid writers, who happen to be celebrities who don't need the money to write for the Huffington Post, were the ones who were really getting all the front page traffic and clicks. So it's sort of like this weird setup where the people who don't need the money are the ones being offered the money, and the people who do are the ones not only not getting paid, but not really getting any sort of leverage out of writing for an outlet like the Huffington Post. Now, this was before they were bought by AOL, so since that buyout, it's become a lot more egregious that they don't pay writers, which I believe was sort of the main thrust of Erica Jong's point.
Yeah, I think a lot of their content, obviously they're a huge website, so they get a lot of attention in these kind of conversations. You know, their content's not paid for, but I know that a lot of websites that I do read don't pay all of their contributors, and I, you know, I don't like it. On the other hand, like, I continue to read The Hairpin, even though I know that none of their content is paid. They have 2 paid editors and that's it. On the other hand, where it starts to get dicier for me is when it's, for instance, like a personal website or someone's Tumblr, where I think I don't have the expectation that I should pay for the content, but then do I think that it's okay for this person to be blogging for free? Like, what if you
start... Are they making money? Is someone making money? I think that's the question.
That's right. The thing. To me, like a Tumblr or a personal blog, that's like the equivalent of a print zine. There's no expectation that that person's going to get paid. Maybe they get some ad revenue, but it's not like they're owned by, you know, BuzzFeed or AOL, and someone else is making money off their labor. Because this really does come down to a labor issue.
I mean, so many writers tell themselves and are told by, you know, mentors that, you know, build a body of work. It doesn't really matter if you're paid or not in the beginning, but that's the way to get to paid jobs. And, you know, I feel like that actually isn't the experience for many writers.
No, it's not. And I think overall, yeah, the profession of writing has been just radically devalued. And I think there's this, you know, the analogy I always use is, you know, you don't tell the guy who comes to fix your plumbing that you're not going to pay him because you'll tell all your friends and he'll get great exposure. There's no expectation that people other than creatives should do their work for free. And why is that? Because it's not really work. You know, all of us who do that work know that that's completely untrue. But we've participated in this climate where we're allowing it to be devalued like that.
Right. And that's where I wonder, you know, what the next step should be, because I think we're all on the same page that this work should be compensated. You know, people shouldn't be publishing for money-making, you know, for-profit sites without getting compensated. But I can understand the position that those writers are in where, you know, they're trying to get a foot in the door, or maybe they really don't need the money and they don't care. And so they enter into these contracts where they're blogging for free, or probably lack of a contract. And so I wonder, you know, what do we think the next step is going to be or should be to sort of turn the tide? Should people put their foot down and say, you know what, Huffington Post, no, you know, I, Alec Baldwin, won't write this editorial for you until you pay?
I do think it has to start at a higher level like mm-hmm. that, with people who are getting paid and who have a platform lobbying for people who, you know, don't. I mean, I don't think we're going to be able to turn the clock back and go back to a time where writers were considered craftspeople instead of unpaid laborers. But yeah, I mean, I think anyone who works for free is essentially devaluing the entire profession. But unfortunately, there are always going to be people who work for free. So there's really, you know, it's kind of trying to hold back the ocean with a broom at this point.
Alec Baldwin. I know you're listening.
Listen up, Alec.
Ask for money from the Huffington Post. I also think, I mean, not to, you know, brag so much about us here at Bitch, but I think, you know, one thing that I think more media outlets should do, we do it here, is to turn down contributors who want to write for free. And that's hard to do sometimes because, you know, we're a nonprofit. We have some really great supporters who want to help us. And one way that some people want to do that is by contributing free content. But, you know, if we do want to see this climate change, I think more media outlets, and I'm thinking more about larger ones, but smaller ones too, have to say, like, not until we have the budget, or we need to figure out a way to pay you, even if it's just a little bit, just to kind of change the practice.
Sure, but that assumes that most outlets are mission-driven rather than profit-driven, and that's just not the case.
Right.
So, I mean, not to, you know, be a total downer.
No, you're right, though.
You know, I think, yeah, it's we're doing it because that's part of our mission. You know, if we were profit-driven, well, we wouldn't be in business right
well,
now.
Well, if we were profit-driven, then we would hopefully have the money to pay our writers.
Yeah, but some of those organizations, that's where their profit comes from, you know.
Well, actually, I don't believe that. Frankly, that I think that they could afford to pay their writers, and that, I mean, is that, are they really making an argument that they can't afford it?
I mean, the Huffington Post is not necessarily making that argument that I know of. It's because they're just basically going with a baseline standard that they set back when they were an independently run organization and not a subsidiary.
I think their argument is that everyone knows what they're getting into. We don't promise payment and then not deliver. Everyone knows they're not going to get paid. You know, on the other hand, that implies total equality between the employer and the employee, which, as most of us probably know, isn't really the case.
It's really important for this to be called out as a labor issue, because plenty of the people that are contributing content to the Huffington Post care deeply about a myriad of progressive issues and are, you know, wanting to get their voices and their thoughts out there on these issues, but are really not considering the labor issues at hand.
We're just going to have to see how this develops. Cross our fingers. If you're a Huffington Post contributor, ask them to pay you, you know. Or stop writing for them.
And write for us.
Write for Bitch and Set. We don't have Arianna Huffington's money, but we will pay you.
But clearly she has it. Yeah. She's not giving it to you. So it's really kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Pitch us over here. Okay, on that note, let's talk a little bit about Nora Ephron, who, as most of our listeners probably know, is a well-known writer, director, journalist, cultural critic, lady about town, who died earlier this week from complications from leukemia at the age of 71, and leaves behind a legacy of written word, films, and a whole lot of other cultural artifacts. So I would assume that we've all got some kind of a personal relationship with Nora Ephron's content. Julie, I know we were talking about her just the other day when we were following this story, and you had a few thoughts, so why don't you get us started?
I was most familiar with her films, you know, earlier on, and I was just never a fan. I'm not a Meg Ryan fan, not a Tom Hanks fan.
We should say probably her most well-known film that she wrote and directed is Sleepless in Seattle.
Really? Not When Harry Met Sally?
Well, she didn't direct that.
Oh, that's true. You're right. Yeah. She didn't.
Well, I definitely have a special place in my heart for When Harry Met Sally because a friend of my dad's is in the movie. But for the most part, her romantic comedies make my skin crawl. And I remember just being so upset by You've Got Mail at the time working for a small bookstore and just felt like the whole movie was a rejection of everything I held dear. But somewhere along the line, I started reading her essays. I just remembered where. The Huffington Post. That
traitor.
What?
Oh my god.
Julie.
Goodness. But that was
she probably wasn't paid for that.
That was probably 3 years ago.
She probably was paid for that.
Well, let's hope she was.
And I really enjoyed her essays. And then there was a profile that was published of her in the New Yorker about 3 years ago. And I began to realize that that I really was curious about her and her life and kind of wanted to be friends with her through her writing. And, you know, I'm not the target demographic, I guess, for I Feel Bad About My Neck. But I read that and loved it, along with
I
Remember Nothing, her two latest books. And actually, a lot of those essays were familiar to me from the Huffington Post. But, you know, she's just a fun person to read at night when you've had a long day. And I think that in the same way that, you know, You've Got Mail and Sleepless in Seattle makes my mom feel like she has a companion in the room. I felt the same way about her essays.
I'm going to have to disagree about with your rom-com feelings. because I rewatched, if I had not just recently rewatched Sleepless in Seattle recently 2 nights ago, I might be more on board because I wasn't a You've Got Mail fan. But Sleepless in Seattle held up so well for me. I probably hadn't seen it in 15 years, and I was only maybe 8 or 9 when it came out, so I remember identifying with the kid in the movie, who was an 8-year-old, Jonah. But rewatching it, I was getting such a kick out of the writing. It's really, like, the fact that it was very much kind of its time culturally, like, they're in Seattle, which was a very hip city in the early 90s, and they're, like, wearing these Eddie Bauer sweaters, and just, like, on the one hand, it felt a little bit like a 1991 time capsule. On the other hand, so much of it still just held up so well. It was very funny. I had forgotten about how much I love the Rob Reiner character in that movie, who's hilarious. Like, it was just so charming. And then, you know, I've read many of her essays, too, and really love her as a writer, but you know, the way that she is able to make these, you know, pretty complicated female characters and put them in a really simple story, just a very basic kind of rom-com that I feel like under a less skilled writer and director would just come across as so formulaic and cheesy, but it's elevated to a higher plane because Nora Ephron did have that ability to make complicated but relatable characters. And if you haven't watched Sleepless in Seattle in a while, it's on Netflix Instant, and I was finding it hilarious.
The Tom Hanks part is probably a big issue.
Did you read his piece, Remembering Her?
No.
You'll eat your words. It was really touching.
It was incredibly touching. I was really tearing up reading all the sort of celebrity tributes and tweets about Nora Ephron. But I also am just like a Nora Ephron fangirl from way back. Like, I totally, fully, like, have a sense memory of the first time I sat down with one of her books because I found it, like, in my mother's, like, stash of books, and I had nothing to read, and I was like, well, shoot, there's an essay in here called, you know, A Few Words About Breasts. I'm totally going to read this. And I think I was, like, I don't know, 9 years old, 10 years old. If you're, like, a Jewish girl growing up in New York City, Nora Ephron is kind of the next step from, like, Judy Blume and Norma Klein in terms of, like, stories about what it's like to be female. When Harry Met Sally came out, I remember going to the theater with a big bunch of friends, and they all wanted to see some, like, action movie that had just come out, and I went by myself to see When Harry Met Sally, and it was so good.
And time has proven you right. I mean, who knows what that action movie was?
Exactly. But. Well, it might have been one of the Die Hard, so I don't know.
Oh, those
I
are mean, still... Okay, those
it's,
hold
it's
up
really
too.
A close call, but, I mean, When Harry Met Sally is one of those movies that whenever it's on, which is pretty much always, like, I will stop what I'm doing and sit down and watch it because it's that good.
That's another one that's so funny. Yeah.
I think it's interesting what you say about, you know, growing up in New York City and her being on this continuum with Judy Blume and Norma Klein, because I grew up in Kentucky and, you know, wanted to be that, you know, New York City girl. And to me, kind of discovering her as an adult, it was absolutely, yes, the next step to really understanding who this quintessential Jewish New York City woman was.
Although
she grew up in Beverly Hills.
I have to say, I was reading some of her New Yorker essays last night, and there was one I had not read before about her apartment in New York and trying to decide if she's going to move out. And I'm somebody, as a West Coast person, who can get pretty resentful and kind of annoyed by this New York-ophilia and just, like, these writers who are just like, the only thing that matters is New York. And it's just, as somebody who grew up in Portland, it's just like, and loves reading, it gets old fast. But with Nora Ephron, it didn't annoy me. She never talks down to anyone. I feel like in all of her essays, you know, you're laughing with her. You don't feel, I guess I often feel in essays where writers talk about their love of New York, I feel excluded by it. You know, like, because I don't live in New York and I've never lived there, I can never understand what you're talking about. And with Nora Ephron, I don't feel that way. It's like you're right there with her in the apartment, just, like, getting a kick out of the doorman, too.
Well, I think her confidence is disarming. It's not intimidating. And that's why you can feel some sort of relationship with her.
Yeah, I feel like the common thread in a lot of the remembrances I've been reading from people who didn't know her was the sentiment that, if I could only get to know her, we would be best friends. You know, this woman had, like, millions of would-be best friends who all thought if they could only, like, get 5 minutes with her, they would just bond.
We've all got so much in common. But, you know, you do feel that way.
You do. I think about her every night when I put moisturizer on my neck because I don't look good in turtlenecks at all.
So you've got to keep the neck up.
Yeah, I got to keep it tight around the neck area.
That's funny. I think of Tina Fey every time I put moisturizer on my eyes because of that section in her book about putting moisture.
And I think about that article I read by a dermatologist that said that moisturizer doesn't do anything and it's all just a hoax to get women to spend money. So
when you put it on?
Yes. When I put it, because, you know, the other voices are still there being like, what if he's wrong? Well, I think, you know, Nora Ephron's work will live on. And Julie, I'd urge you to rewatch Sleepless in Seattle and just see. Okay, at this point, Andy and I went to go see Magic Mike at the theater with Kristen, our art director. So the next section that you'll hear will be the three of us talking about the movie.
This is Kelsey Wallace, web editor at Bitch, and with me are Andy Zeisler and Kristen Rogers Brown, and we have just returned from the movie theater where we saw Magic Mike, the new Steven Soderbergh film starring Channing Tatum, Matthew McConaughey, and Alex Pettifer about a group of male strippers, and specifically two of them who have to find themselves and try on a lot of thongs. So let's get started. Kristen, why don't you first just tell us, what were your impressions of the movie? You know, we just got out of the theater a few minutes ago, so how are you feeling?
If you feel the need to say, woo!
Yeah, right. I'm more sort of, I think I'm still digesting it, as Andy sort of said in the movie, but I think I was most struck by Matthew McConaughey's fantastic sleaziness and songwriting skills.
So give us a little bit of a background on his character. Who's McConaughey in this movie?
Right. So he's a lot like some of the other like sleazy Matthew McConaughey characters that he's played, just maybe a little bit more grown up and more entrepreneurial. But his name's Dallas, because he's probably from Texas or celebrates Texas in some way.
Or McConaughey has it in his contract that everyone he plays has to have some connection to Texas.
That's probably true.
Yeah.
And he's kind of the ringleader of the group as well. And
he's kind of the villain, if you think
about
it.
Yeah, he's a little bit of the villain.
Yeah. That's, I mean, not to spoil it.
Oh, I think we can spoil it.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert for this entire, because at least I was going to
spoiler alert, there are some buts.
I was going to spoil some stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I liked that the movie wasn't as straightforward as I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was really expecting a kind of a better made Showgirls, but with guys, you know, that was just like, stripping is a sort of seedy underbelly of the city, but like these hot guys are just gonna bring sex to it, and then the main character is gonna have a realization by the end of the movie. The realization kind of happened, but you know,
I feel like that's exactly what it was.
I felt like they complicated it a little bit more, or at least I felt like maybe Soderbergh has a better directing hand than, say, Verhoeven, the director of Showgirls.
Right, because I think you could make an argument that in some ways it's kind of glorifying the lifestyle, because they do seem to be having a lot of fun, and Magic Mike's young protege just is like having the best time ever, even though he kind of ends up messing it up.
But it's also like a little bit more relatable, because it's not like this, I guess maybe the acting's better too.
Whoa.
I'm not gonna lie to you. I think the acting might be better than in Showgirls, and that kind of saved it, because I actually like cared about the character a little bit.
I agree, and I felt like everyone in it was really good. I mean, McConaughey, you know, obviously pulled out all the sort of like sleaziness that we love him for.
But there was enough charm.
But I'm not even talking about him. I mean, it's like, you know, I know, Kelsey, you have a larger frame of Channing Tatum reference. but he was really good, you know, at being someone who you could see as like a good time guy who was also very serious and also kind of conflicted about what he was doing.
I think I do have a little larger of a Tatum frame, because I'm a Step Up completist. I've seen all the Step Up movies. And I used to hate Channing Tatum. In the first Step Up movie, I thought he was horrible. And then over time, he's grown on me to the point where I was feeling really affected by the scene where he was driving and crying in this movie. Like, I thought, you know, Channing Tatum has arrived for me as an actor who I support, because I was just like, no. Fuck up, dude. Like, when he was, there's a driving scene where he gets like a tear kind of running down his face, and he just really sold it. I thought
it's also highlighted by the fact that he's shirtless except for a vest.
That's true.
Which I did not notice until after the crying scene, which tells you something about how good the crying scene is.
Yeah.
The driving scene.
But what I think is really interesting, since, you know, it is a movie about strippers, is how the marketing of the movie really kind of obscures what the focus is.
Yeah.
Basically, the way this movie is marketed, you would think it's a movie about Joe Manganiello being naked.
Oh,
and it's not at all. Like, he has a very small part.
And in fact, you really see it.
Except actually, he's the only one whose part we see in the movie, and it is not small.
Well, but we see it in shadow, and I don't think we see as much of him naked as we do the other people, which I thought was interesting compared to like how it's marketed.
Exactly. I mean, Kelsey and I were talking before about how Alex Pettyfer, who plays sort of the young protege, I feel like he's been absent from all the marketing, and I'm wondering why that is, or if it's intentional, or if it's because, you know, he's just not sort of stereotypically hunky.
Or I wonder, too, if at least I haven't seen him in anything before, which doesn't mean that he isn't, like, the star of a TV show that's just off my radar, but maybe this is his breakout role, and they're not really, like, they're doing press with the guys who already have a following as hunks.
Right.
But I noticed that, too. I mean, you wouldn't... I was also surprised by what a large role his character had in the movie, because I didn't think... I also didn't know that it was basically going to be, like, a stripper version of, like, Training Day. Like, I didn't think that it was going to be...
You know, that was like, going to be the tagline, and then they were like, you know, it's not going to be appealing.
Stripping Training Day. Because, you know, obviously there's this progression among the characters. You know, you've got McConaughey, who's older, the sort of, like, guru/villain to these guys. And you can kind of see that he's grooming Channing Tatum's character, Magic Mike, to follow in his footsteps. And that then, in turn, Magic Mike is grooming the kid, Adam, that played by Alex Pettyfer, to follow him. And, you know, they're all going to kind of be on this career path. But we know, the audience, that Magic Mike wants more out of life than just being Matthew McConaughey 10 years from now. And, you know, I didn't... The publicity for the movie did not tip me off to that trajectory. I thought it was going to be much more just about Channing Tatum. I didn't really know about the protege character, and I liked it. I thought it gave a good frame for us to kind of both like and dislike both of those characters in a way that I liked their relationship. I felt like Alex Pettyfer played a really believable 19-year-old. Like,
yeah, I agree with that,
a lot of
too.
The way that he was acting, you're just like, oh, I have to keep remembering that he's just, like, kind of young and doofy. Like, when he asks Magic Mike to be his best friend, and, like, it was just kind of cute and so embarrassing. And his relationship with his sister, too. I was most apprehensive going to the movie about the Cody Horn character. I was just worried that, like, the girl in this movie was going to be just kind of a mess of sort of stereotypes, and like, of course she's got to be the uptight one because, you know, stripping is whatever. There was some of that, but I actually really liked her relationship with her brother.
Well, I think too, the relationship with her boyfriend early in the movie sort of showed she was dating this sort of guy that was more uptight than she was mm-hmm. in the movie, and it kind of set her up as not being as, like, I guess a little bit more relatable.
That's
too.
A really good point. Yeah, he was like a total stuffed shirt, and you could tell she was into him, but not, also a little bit embarrassed.
Right.
And he also seemed a little bit douchey.
Yeah, just kind of self-centered.
And kind of just, like, there was no recognition of, like, her character
exactly.
in him and
yeah.
who he was, even though he was pretty
mm-hmm.
minimal, kind of cardboard.
But I was glad they had that scene at the beginning showing them on a date, because it did help us, like, get her a little more.
Right.
Basically, she was more three-dimensional than I anticipated. And so was the Olivia Munn character. I mean, I don't think that this is necessarily a Bechdel test passing movie. but the women were... I was nervous that they were really going to be just, like, cardboard cutouts. And I didn't think that that happened.
Well, there was this... It's sort of like... The male characters sort of were reflected in the female characters and vice versa, where you could sort of... you sort of felt bad for the male characters with how they were seen through these women's eyes, because you knew that they were more complicated than, like, the three main women that they interact with the movie, the third one being the woman at the bank who turns him down for a loan, turns Magic Mike down for a loan.
And then there's also Nora, the drug addict who has a pet
right.
pig.
Who's also
Let's not forget the pig.
Elvis's granddaughter.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yes. Or no, Lisa Marie Presley's.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right.
Priscilla's granddaughter.
Exactly.
Wow. She was beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah.
And she has a pig. And the pig really steals the movie.
A scene stealer. He was adorable.
Absolutely.
Even when he's eating vomit. Got
yeah.
a little pig.
Even especially, your heart goes out to the pig.
Yeah.
I mean, what's a pig going to eat?
But on the eating vomit note, I will say I was talking in the car on the way back from the movie that we saw it at 11:50 a.m., and I had been kind of, I'd been pushing for a midnight show last night and couldn't get enough momentum going. But I was kind of disappointed to see it in the daytime because I had imagined myself bringing drinks into the theater and kind of treating it like a real strip club. And I'm glad I did not do that. If you are listening and were planning on doing that, I would argue against it. I felt like the movie went darker than I thought it would. And especially with some of the camera work, like if you're drunk or high during this movie, I think you're going to get really just...
You're not going to be comfortable.
You're not going to feel good about it.
Yeah. If you must see it drunk, make plans to see it again maybe a few days later so you can fully process the enormity of what's going on while you're drunk.
I mean, because I think a lot of people are going to have, like, bottles of...
Yeah, people are going to show up with penis-shaped straws.
Which I suggested for last night, by the way. So these people are me.
They're
going to
show up with cans of pink champagne. And they might feel a little weird after.
It does not have the bachelorette party vibe that you might think. Which I am refreshed by.
Yeah.
It felt more, like you said, Kristen, more relatable, more realistic. On the other hand, you know, if you're looking for basically an all-male review from the movie theater seat instead of paying $20 at the door, it's not totally what it is. There are moments like that.
There was a lot of actual performing in the movie, too.
And some of it was really, you know, I don't want to say impressive, but, like, Channing Tatum, I mean, again, Kelsey knew this, but that dude can dance.
Yeah, seriously.
And he's a self-taught dancer. There's, you know, there's something to his narrative. This film is based loosely on his experience as a stripper. I don't think necessarily that the narrative arc is, but, like, the dancing and that the scene in Tampa. And, you know, there's a reason why he was chosen to star in this movie. He's clearly the best dancer out of the group.
Yeah.
He's featured way more for a reason. Like, the other guys were cute, but they were not. They did not have the moves. There was a real range of stripping abilities.
And stripping themes, which does make it sort of fun to see from, like, a review standpoint. There were some really cheesy and funny, like, themed acts, clearly driven by Matthew McConaughey's character.
I loved the props, and it was like they kept the stage show cheesy enough that you could believe that this was, you know, a Tampa hotspot on the weekends, but it didn't go into, like, Vegas budget territory.
Right. Yeah, low budge.
Yeah.
For sure.
One thing that I did find a little hard to swallow was that it would be all women in the crowd.
I was actually wondering about that. And I wonder if there, you know, having been to exactly zero male reviews in my lifetime, I don't know if there, I mean, I know when I lived in San Francisco, there were clubs that definitely appealed to a male crowd and clubs that appealed to, like, a straight female crowd, but I don't know what the scene would be like in Tampa.
It did seem
a little incongruous, though.
Yeah, and that all the men, we didn't really get a lot of backstory on the strippers except for the main two, but they appeared to be straight. And I don't know a ton about male stripping, but the little bit that I do know has me believing that there are, you know, that's kind of unrealistic, that it would be all straight guys,
mm-hmm.
you know. Then again, I've never been to Tampa.
I have been to Tampa, believe it or not.
Hey,
and,
expert!
The best, once for like 5 days, so, you know, but it was totally not, I went there for spring break, and it was totally not a spring break town. It was like somewhat suburban, bigger city, you know, with...
Isn't it like the national capital of, like, death metal?
Oh. If I had known that, I think I would have been a lot more intrigued by it.
Did you feel it was misrepresented in this movie?
No, not at all. I feel like the whole... I mean, it was sort of portrayed as this sort of small market, like, off-brand of Florida beach party, you know? That,
with a lot of regulars.
Right.
Well, because the whole point in the movie was that they were going to, like, the big move was to Miami. Like,
right.
Where they could really make some real money.
Which I think is totally realistic.
Yeah, there was enough. I mean, I'm not a male stripper. I don't really know any male strippers that well. But it felt realistic enough that it wasn't totally glorifying stripping, but it doesn't make it seem awful either.
Right.
You know? Well, to wrap it up, would you recommend this movie to others?
I think I already did.
Yeah, I would. I think if you're on the fence about going, you might just think that you're in for a little more than just like a romp kind of movie. But if you're up for it, I think it was actually good.
I agree. Great movie. So we're agreed.
Yes.
Three thumbs up.
Yes. Go see Magic Mike, but prepare yourself. Leave the champagne for after.
Thanks for tuning in. You can find links to stuff we talked about today, as well as more audio offerings, at bitchmedia.org/audio.